History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And of course, we've learned they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and then invest the time to listen patiently as long-buried memories take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This week, we're going to mark the 78th anniversary of the worst naval disaster in American history, the tragic sinking of the cruiser USS Indianapolis, which had just delivered components of the atomic bomb to Tinian. If you're familiar with the saga of the Indianapolis, if you've read books like In Harm's Way by Doug Stanton or Indianapolis by Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladeck, especially if you've watched Sarah's incredible documentary, USS Indianapolis, The Legacy, or perhaps simply you're a longtime Hometown Heroes listener who's heard survivors of that sinking share their stories here. You know it's a story that continues to develop over time. From the posthumous exoneration of the ship's captain in the year 2000, to the discovery of the Indy's wreckage 3.5 miles deep in the Pacific Ocean in 2017, you may recall that only 316 of the 1,195 men aboard the Indy survived, and each year at ship reunions, the number of survivors has grown smaller and smaller. This year's reunion was held in California's East Bay, home to the last living survivor of the ship sinking, Harold Bray, who got to see a bronze statue erected in his honor in his adopted hometown of Benicia. Or Benicia, as Harold has always pronounced it. Just a couple of days later, the reunion concluded with the unveiling of a new book that uncovers some never-before-told history about the men aboard the Indy for that fateful mission. At least the 28 of them referred to in the book's title as Heroes in the Shadows. You can find video of the complete memorial ceremony that closed this year's reunion on the USS Indianapolis Facebook page, and I also have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. But today, we're going to hear from the women who wrote this new book as part of their own collective process of discovery, sharing some of what they've learned about the 28 African-American members of the Indy's crew. To get us started, here is Jane Gwynn Goodall, who was born into the USS Indianapolis family because without her father, it's quite possible that none of us would have ever heard any of the details of what happened in the early morning hours of July 30th, 1945. If you'd like to order the book, I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com as well as the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. Again, the title is Heroes in the Shadows, the untold story of the African-American sailors aboard USS Indianapolis.
The book is significant because the story's never been told. And I have grown up with this story. I'm the daughter of the pilot that spotted the survivors. So as long as I've known about USS Indianapolis, the word USS Indianapolis, and the term the survivors for as long as I can remember. They've been a part of my life. In their family homes, they've been in our family home. My husband and I moved to Michigan in 1988. Many, many miles from California, and some of those survivor families, the Thielens, the Wisniewskis, they became second family to me. So this has been a network for me growing up of extended family. So I've always known the story. I've known it from the books. I've known about the 317 survivors, and I've stayed connected long enough to realize that that number is an error, that it's actually 316 survivors. And I've known that 879 perished on the ship, but I never really thought much about that other than the number. It's a pretty staggering number, 3 out of every 4 that went down with the ship. It's a pretty staggering account of time when you think about how quickly that ship went down. I often think about, you know, in our everyday lives, we go to an ATM, you pull up, You park your car, you get out, you get your money, you count it, you get back in the car. 15 minutes is gone. That's how quickly that ship went down. That's those chaotic moments. So I thought about those things. And then, you know, we started the legacy organization to follow what the survivors had started. But as their organization progressed towards an end, we see this as ramping up to a new beginning of keeping this story going through the generations. And I have a generation kind of pet peeve anyways, because I've been doing a scholarship for friends for the last 15 years in my dad's name. So that's my connection to the story. I got involved with Legacy Organization on a fundamental, foundational level, really. And Sarah and I became in charge of reunions. Well, we're all set with the big 2020 reunion, the 75th anniversary. And we thought, let's put together some pictorial commemorative edition. We started working on that, and Sarah had the list of all the sailors and the ranks. What we didn't have, what nobody ever had, were pictures. What do these guys look like? You know, let's personalize this. So I was all on board for that. I thought we'd have a huge committee of people working on it. Not so much. It was pretty much Sarah and me. But we still had this naive idea, like, how hard could it be? You know, you got the names. How hard can it be to find 1,195 photos of men in 1945? And it proved to be a pretty daunting task. There are some great, great outcomes that came from it, but we were short. By the time we had to go to publication, we're still short to this day. We're missing about 300, and I don't know the latest count, but I think it's around 340 photos. About 50 of them are survivors, which you wouldn't think would be hard to find, but not every survivor story is a happy story. And about 282 of the Lost at Sea families. So as I'm going through, finding these photos, documenting their hometown, their birth date. We knew their name, we knew their rank, and we knew what date they boarded the ship. What we weren't completely sure of was hometown, because we were drawing this from the last documentation, which was the notifications to the families that said the parents' names, and it said the address of where that notification was being sent to. And we didn't have birth dates, because you get that mainly from draft cards or birth certificates, and the Navy didn't provide that to us. So that was our starting point, their parents' names, that supposed location, their ranks, their names, and when they boarded. And what we wanted to do was create a visual to really emphasize that 3 out of every 4 perished. So we did it in black and white, with those that didn't survive being pictured in black, and those that did survive being pictured in white, and then a distinction for Marines, which was an outline in red. As I started researching that, and I'm seeing all these fresh, young, 17, 18, 20-year-old faces, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, there's so much potential. There's so much life in these guys. They're nice, young-looking guys, you know, probably ones I would have maybe looked at in high school, you know, had it been then. But it humanized it for me. And I hadn't really ever... I'd seen pictures of them as they aged, but I hadn't really seen a whole complement. And I'd seen group pictures, but without names to it. So as we're researching and I'm checking the boxes, you know, of who we found, I kept running into this roadblock about the African-American crew. We had about 6 photos to start with, so I knew there were African-Americans on the crew. And then I started realizing the similarity between their ratings and ranks to what was missing in my unknown category, and started putting it together. And we did the best we could putting that commemorative book together, but we fell short of telling a bigger part of the story. We did the best we could, but we still fell short. And I just felt we could do better and decided to challenge myself to make that better.
And not to interrupt, but I hear you say that, and I wonder where that comes from. Do you hear your father's voice in your head? Is that a spiritual thing? What is that desire to dig deeper, as if somehow you haven't done enough yet? Where does that come from?
It's really interesting you ask that, because I've asked myself that question. And I walk every morning. And one of the days when I was walking, that's the question that was in my head. Why you, Jane? Why is this so important to you? And the thought that comes to my head is my dad. And that the idea that he was flying this plane at a high altitude, they had trouble with his trailing antenna. He goes in the back to help them. He's now looking at the problem from a different angle. He looks straight down out of the belly of the plane, and he sees this oil slick. And he gets real excited, and he goes back up, and this is how the whole rescue thing started. And I think about that, and I think that's kind of what we're doing. You know, we've been flying at a high altitude from one point of view for a long time, and something came up that changed our view of it, and that made me want to go dig deeper.
And it sure sounds like you haven't been disappointed by what you've uncovered.
No, because I've not only uncovered more information, but I've uncovered new friendships, and I've connected people to this story that felt so unconnected before. But it took longer than we thought. We really thought we were just going to do this. We started it right after the 2020 reunion. We thought we could have this pictorial little publication together in time for Black History Month and then, you know, everybody. But no, then we realized there was so much more to the story, so much more history there that needed to be told to set the context of it. Why were these guys in one special unit all, you know, separated? We know now that there were 28 African-American crew members. We know that through the work that we did in digging deeper. We still don't know what really happened to them. Most people think that all of them perished on impact. That's not true. We do know that some were still working. They were working during the explosion. They were on shift to work. They were getting ham sandwiches or they were serving officers. They were struggling in that cloud of smoke and gasping for air. Because when you think about where their quarters were, their segregated quarters, they were below the officers' mess, but above the ammunition stores. And the ammunition stores is where that second torpedo hit. So there were explosions. Anybody sleeping in those quarters probably would have been killed on impact. But those that were working, and remember, this is change of shift, right? This happened right at change of shift, so part of the ship was totally impacted. The back part of the ship, for those first few minutes, seemed normal. Then it started listing and rocking. We do know that at least two, jumped off at the fantail and were caught in the screws. We know that from one survivor's account who was in the water at the time and yelling, "No, no, don't do it." That's a sight that survivor has never been able to unsee. We know that there was somebody working in the officer's mess that got John Walston a ham sandwich, but also found the wrench to unlock the porthole. We don't know why he didn't go out other than trying to catch his breath. We don't know if he just was looking for another way or looking for a buddy. We don't know. What we do know is that none were counted among the survivors, and none of them by markings, names, or skin color or anything were documented in the 91 that were picked up during the recovery efforts the following days. So we don't know, you know, what happened to them in the water. We do know what happened to Al Saleh, how he wasn't allowed up on board, but we don't know that that is something that happened to them. Or, yeah, we don't know. But what we do know is that they were part of this crew, and their names deserve to be told, and their backstory needs to be told. And this is their history, too. We know that there are families that they didn't want to talk about it because it was too painful. And now, that's how it started with the survivors, too. They didn't want to talk about it at the beginning. That's one of the things that happened from the reunions, is that they had a chance to talk about it and then process it. And then they started opening up to their families and then telling, and then they started really opening up when they had grandchildren and the grandkids are doing history projects about World War II. And then the books come out and then, you know, people start talking about it. But if you hold it inside, that's just a lot of pain.
So can you help us understand what these ladies that you wrote the book with, what getting to know them, hearing their perspective, watching their journey of discovery, what that's meant to you?
There's been so many things. First of all, Gina I met first because I asked her to do the Lost at Sea panel that we were doing for the 75th anniversary. And so it brought in a whole nother perspective. And she's so eloquent and she just really, you know, uses her words very wisely. Her father was my inspiration. Finding him in looking for photos, I mean, he unlocked that door for me, made me think it was possible. So then Gina came in and kind of rode along beside me. And I promised to Gina at that time, I said, "I really want to take this story further. Would you like to help me?" And she said, "Yes." Well, she's a practicing physician. So, you know, we're working day jobs in here too. And then I had found Arlene because she had submitted her uncle's photo, but they didn't know his birth date, and they didn't know actually where he was actually born. The Navy had said Washington, D.C. So just even researching them, we never did find his draft card, but we found his birth certificate. His mother was 16 when she had him. He was not born in Washington, D.C., but in Beaver Dam, Virginia. And it turns out he was one of the oldest members of the crew. He was 38 years old. And then Magellan Williams, that was a fun thing. We found Jackie Dugan through Facebook. They had, you know, we'd done all this social media around the commemorative gold medal, and they had written in, how would we get a gold medal for our aunt, Magellan Williams' sister, who's going to be 100 in November? And so I'm not big on social media. I don't do it very much, but we have team members who do, and they found her. They dug around. They found that connection and contacted her. We actually sent her, I think, a gold medal, the bronze. Yeah. And I couldn't find Jackie's number, but I found her daughter's number. I think it was her daughter that had submitted that request. So then I contacted the daughter, said, you don't know me from Adam. You don't know what, you know, but here's what we're working on. And I'm wondering if you can put me in touch with your mom. So she contacted her mom to see if her mom would be interested. And then her mom contacted me and said, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And then she brought in Ernestine, and then Arlene brought in Janice because Janice loves to do that. So it's been a growing experience for them, too. I mean, there's pain at the beginning. You heard Ernestine talk about her mom, clammed. But her dad, we got on videotape talking about boot camp in 1945 and his experience of going in there. And he wanted the Army. He liked the Army uniforms. He did not want the Navy. But they pretty much just told him where he was going to go. He remembers being in a room. There were all these men, all black men standing in a room, all naked, just, you know, being assigned somewhere. And then he gets sent to boot camp, but it's weeks before they can start boot camp because they had to have a full complement of people. So that was a bonding experience for them with their dad. They would never sit and put him on videotape or ask him these interview questions unless there was a purpose to doing it, because there was this boundary that the family didn't cross in asking those questions. But this gave them a purpose to cross those boundaries.
Obviously, we want everybody to pick up Heroes in the Shadows and read it and expand their perspective a little bit. But I get the sense that you kind of anticipate more. As long as you've been at this, as many layers of history you've uncovered, as many connections as you've made, is there something you find yourself still wondering, still looking forward to, still hoping to dig up somewhere?
Always. It's really interesting. I think there's a curiosity that fuels that. We still, out of the 28, we have 11 photos. I would love to find more. I hope that this will help people connect with that. We still have a lot of photos to find. Sarah and I will be working on an updated yearbook, if you will, all those faces and names for the 80th anniversary. That's what we want to do. It means a lot when you see the face. You feel like you get to know them a little bit. They're not just a name. They're a person. They're an entity with a family, with whatever. You know, they exist. I studied the list of names all my growing up years, and I focused in on either asterisk by their name, which meant that they were a survivor, or on some of the lists they had them geographically, so I would look, you know, ones in our area, or I would look at names that were, like, your last name is Leffler, and if my name had been Leffler, I would have looked, and if I would have found that Paul Leffler on that ship list, that would have excited me just to have that connection. So there's a lot left to uncover. We have a group through Legacy that is actually focusing on, they call it Project 888, and it stands for the 879 that went down with the ship and the 9 from the kamikaze attack that we lost. We have put their names to it. We're still searching for some other ones, but now we want to have their families share their story. So we're constantly looking for that, and people can contribute through the website. So yeah, there's always a lot. I mean, that's the thing that's surprising. Even people here at this reunion were saying, we've been coming to reunions forever, but every reunion we come to, we learn something new. We learn something new. So I hope that never ends, because that's how we keep people engaged.
That's Jane Gwynn Goodall, daughter of the pilot who first spotted the oil slick where the USS Indianapolis went under 78 years ago this week. Jane is listed as author of this new book, Heroes in the Shadows, with contributions from five other women, all of whom lost relatives in the tragedy. We're going to hear from some of them when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As we mark the 78th anniversary this weekend of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis, we're focusing on the latest chapter of the ship's incredible story, illuminated by the newly published book, Heroes in the Shadows. Complete with photos, official documents, and family contributions, it showcases the African-American members of the ship's crew, all of whom were counted among the 879 lives lost in the worst sea disaster in American naval history. Let's hear from more of this book's authors.
I am Jeanette Pitts. I am the niece of Steward's Mate First Class Albert Rice. He was the brother of my father, Leroy Pitts.
Help me understand, if you can go back in your memory, the first thing that you started to hear about your uncle and what got you interested in his story and his legacy.
Well, my father has always made us very aware of all of our family alive and deceased, my uncle included. So I can't remember a time that I didn't know about my uncle. We always referred to him by his nickname. My family called him Bud, and so to us, he was always Uncle Bud. I mean, we knew his legal name, but he was always Uncle Bud. And my father, throughout our lives, would recount stories of their growing up. We learned to respect him. We recognized him as one of the leaders of their family that helped keep their family together once their mom had died. So we grew up with a very deep love and respect for this person whom we never saw.
How much did you really know about him as far as who he was, what he was like, what he went through?
Separate from the Indianapolis, I knew as much about him as I did any of my other aunts and uncles. I can't emphasize enough that to me, he was a real living person. It was just like a relative that happened to live in another state that you never got a chance to see, but there were so many stories, and he was just a part of the conversation as life went on. There were activities or things that we did that my father would comment that was like Bud, or you're being like Bud there. And so he just was really very much a part of our lives as if he were still living himself. He was my father's older brother, and as the older brother in a family where the mother died when my father was 6 years old, he and his twin sister, Alberta, helped to keep the five children together and support them. And so we had respect for him as an elder in that sense. Even though he was 20 years old when he passed, I always thought of him as being an elder and had respect for that. With respect to the Indianapolis, when it was the appropriate time, and I can't tell you what age I was because I actually don't recall, but at the appropriate time, my father did let us know that he had been on this ship. He let us know about the ship, and he actually showed to each of us at that time when I was growing up, the only book out was Abandoned Ship. My father had a copy of it. For me, it was difficult to actually read because my youthful sensitivities could not quite stomach the pain of it from that perspective. I know one of my other brothers did read it very early as a teen, but I was fully aware of the significance of the ship. He raised us to know that, to understand that, to respect that. My family has a long history of military service dating before my uncle to my great-grandfather and since. So as a part of what my uncle did and his sacrifice, his service, that was just another step and another example of what was instituted into us in terms of really respecting our country and really trying to make sure that our country lives up to its own ideals. And we believed and were raised to understand that part of what Uncle Bud did was a part of that service. My father was a Korean War veteran, and even though his brother, during the last Liberty, my uncle went home. And when he was home, one of the things he had shared with my father is that war is hell. And if you can stay out of war, you know, that it would be a good thing. But my father also went on, though, went into the military as a young man and served in Korea and Japan.
And in unveiling this book and talking about it, you shared a speech that your father had written. You had some quotes from him, including a passage of scripture that seemed to be pretty significant to him with regard to this whole project and where it's going now. Can you share that with us?
He was really commenting on just the theistic perspective that he relied upon, a reflection of his cultural African-American background, that really has a belief that light can triumph over darkness. And if you think about it, there was darkness. Just in the fact, just war in and of itself is a certain darkness and evil in the world amongst men, but that light can triumph over that. There are injustices done, and we know in terms of the African-American soldiers not having been represented, that in and of itself was an injustice, but that our light and better understanding and openness, people being willing to face truths, acknowledge them, and then we carry on and we move forward and we do better for the future. So in terms of his own pain, in terms of processing what happened to his brother, what happened to all of the men on the Indianapolis as a young man, he relied upon this belief that was instilled in him by his own folks, his family, that's strong in our family, that is strong in our African-American culture, that light can triumph over darkness. And that's what I tried to share. He did write, he penned a letter after receiving and reading the book that just expressed some of those thoughts, that appreciation, because he's longed for African-American sailors to be acknowledged, to be recognized. He did attend the 1995 reunion that the Indianapolis had. It was the first reunion that was open to Lost at Sea families. And at that point, he, as many others, went to the podium to make comments. And one of his comments was just wanting it to be acknowledged that African-American sailors had served on the Indianapolis, and his hope that as future books were written, that would come to light and would be included.
So now the book is here. So you've been a part of fulfilling his vision all these years later. What does that mean to see this in print, to see your uncle's story and these other sailors' stories in print, and know that when the story gets told from here on out, that's going to be part of that picture?
Words cannot express how significant that is for me, and it is most significant that this happened in my father's lifetime. My father was 13 years old when the ship went down. He's 91 now. It was my greatest fear that this would not come to fruition in his lifetime. And the fact that it has come in his lifetime, where he is actually doing very well, was able to contribute in terms of interviews and sharing information with me and for us to share on with the committee. The fact that this has happened where he can appreciate it, that is most meaningful to me. This whole journey has been wonderful. When we started out, we really didn't have expectation to be able to get much information, just some basic biographical data, if that, and we thought that we'd be able to complete it in 6 months in time for the next African American History Month. And we soon found out that that was not the case. And as we met every month, a part of much of our early meetings were just discussions in terms of our history, our African-American culture, and history as it relates to many different aspects. And that informed a lot of how the book evolved and how it developed, and that shed light that we had to expand beyond just these 28 men to a perspective, and we'll have to give people a frame of reference with respect to what has happened in our world, in our country, specifically with the Navy and the military in general, as pertains to persons of color and the experience that they have. So this is just a beginning. I mean, this definitely does not tell the entire story. This opens a small window, and it is our hope that people will take it from here, and minds will and hearts will continue to be open. The same can be spoken of other cultures, other races that may have experienced some of the same kinds of injustices. But in particular for the African American military personnel and the African American naval personnel, we hope it is just the beginning of what will be expanded upon in the future.
Was it meaningful to line up with your fellow authors and the people who put so much time in putting this book together, and to have the last survivor of the sinking sitting at that table with you, Harold Bray?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that I did get a chance to say to Mr. Bray, and although I know we all call him Harold, but again, from my culture perspective, you know, he's Mr. Bray, but Mr. Harold. One of the things that I did share is I sat there and put my arm around him, and he asked me if my uncle had made it, and I let him. I said, no, he did not. I said, but you are here, and you are his shipmate, and that is meaningful to me. So yes, it does help in terms of bringing things full circle, because we know at that time, wherever Harold Bray and many of his other crew were, they may not have even known, had they not been an officer, may not have been aware as much of the existence, of the presence of the African-American crew. Some were, but the vast majority weren't. But the fact that we now in 2023, you know, the niece of one of his shipmates can sit beside him and put her arm around him and know that in this sense we are one, that is meaningful to me.
That was Dr. Jeanette Pitts, Gina as she's known among her fellow contributors to the book Heroes in the Shadows. Again, that's linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and we get to meet another one of those contributors now. She happens to be a veteran herself, having served in the U.S. Air Force.
My name is Ernestine Pete, and I'm from Memphis, Tennessee.
And your relative on the ship was?
Magellan Williams, my uncle.
So, take me back as far as you can. What's the first you remember hearing about this uncle that you never met?
The first time I heard about my Uncle Magellan was on Memorial Day when I was probably about 9 or 10 years old. And my mother kept crying. On Memorial Day, we were very patriotic. We voted as a family. We talk about all the politics of the world and the military. My father woke us up at 5 o'clock every morning when we were little kids, and we had to do exercises because he was a World War II Navy veteran. So Memorial Day to my mom meant that the Japanese killed her brother, and she never forgave them for that, and never forgave the captain for that. So we would mention Uncle Magellan because we would always ask my mother, can you tell us a little bit about him? She said, I was 13 years old when I got the telegram. It was in the mail. It said my brother was lost at sea, and my parents weren't home, and I couldn't figure out, do I tell them or do I just keep it? She said, I just cried all day. They came back from the store. Then when she told her mother, she remembers her mother falling to the floor, running. Then she got up and ran down the street. So then my aunt, Eunice, who's 103 years old, ever since then we would always ask, Aunt Eunice, tell us about Uncle Magellan. She would always say, I'm not going to talk about that. I'm not going to talk about that. And to this day, at 103, she still doesn't talk about it. She hasn't even seen the book. She doesn't want anything to do with it. She says she does not want to talk about it, and she means that. But my mom, on the other hand, we've tried to show her the movie. We've given her hats and T-shirts and talked about it. And until recently, as I said earlier, my sister gave her the book, and then she smiled, and it was like she was trying to find some peace. But I do remember Doug Stanton was talking to my mother about the book when we were working on it. And all of a sudden, my nice, quiet mother was like, "That captain should burn in hell." And it was like, "Mom!" And we were just running, trying to grab the phone from it, you know. But it was just hard. And we have his picture on our wall at home. We grew up looking at him in his Navy uniform, but we really didn't find out anything about him. We had to really dig. What we do know is he was engaged, and his fiance lost a child, and she had a mental breakdown. And that's what we remember about that. So it's like my sister and I want to make sure that nobody in the family forgets about everything that he's gone through. And my dad, while we were doing this story, my father kept telling me, he said, "Ernestine, you cannot look at it through your eyes as Air Force vet, Vietnam Air Force vet. You have to look at it through our eyes." He said it was two different worlds. It was a black one and a white one. And he said that he even remembers when they were on like their last liberty, and he said that he went to this, it was like a dance, but it was some white sailors there, and they just started talking, and then the next thing he knew, the police were saying, "Separate, separate," and he was like, whoa, it was just two different worlds. But we just really wanted to get the word out and let people know.
Since you mentioned that, having served in the integrated armed forces, you know, decades after your father and your uncle, how jarring was that to have your father say that? Could you even compute that kind of reality?
Well, my situation is a little different, and yes, I can, because I understand that when you listen to people and they tell their story, you can't look at their story through your eyes. You have to really put yourself in their place. My uncle Magellan being Navy, and then my dad was in the same war. We began to ask my father questions about that, and then I joined the Air Force because I didn't want to be bothered with the swimming and things like that. I know there's a myth. I do swim, but I just didn't want to be pushed into it, you know. So I joined the Air Force, my brother joined the Air Force, and then the sad thing about that was I became a disabled vet because the military, they apologized for accidentally sterilizing me, and it was like, killed my brother, you sterilized my child, and my dad helped me out of that being in the military. He understood that. So you could see how the dynamics of our family is like, wow. But my brother went Air Force. His son is still in the Air Force, 18 years, and he's doing that drone stuff. I was air traffic controller, so our family is very military oriented. We understand one thing, that we have to protect our country. It hurts. It's sad. There's tears. I cry. My dad died in 96, right before the book came out. But thank God for the book, because I was able to record him talking about life in World War II. And I have that on Google Drive, you know, so thank God for this story.
So if someone's listening and they buy the book and they're reading through it, what's the most important thing you hope they get out of reading through your uncle's story and the story of those other sailors?
I hope they understand that we're all family, we're all human, we're all one. We have to fight for our country, love each other. That's all.
Ernestine Peet, whose uncle Magellan Williams was one of the Gold Star heroes lost on the USS Indianapolis 78 years ago this week. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, more perspectives from the Gold Star families who have collaborated on the new book, Heroes in the Shadows, revealing an aspect of the USS Indianapolis saga that has really never been told before. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend. It's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode marking the 78th anniversary of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis by exploring an element of that ship's incredible story that has remained hidden for all these years. The supreme sacrifice of all 28 members of the ship's crew who had been restricted to specific duties aboard ship because of the color of their skin. The Navy was segregated, of course, at the time, and by now you may have read through the lines. If it had not been segregated, if African Americans had access to every potential position on the crew that other sailors had, surely some of them, at least one of them, would have been counted among the Indianapolis's 316 survivors. We're going to hear now from another one of the women whose efforts produced this new book, Heroes in the Shadows, Janice Alston.
My aunt Arlene, she is a historian of the family, and she had told us long ago that we had an uncle that was on the ship, but we never saw any African Americans on it. She did more research prior to the 75th commemoratory celebration that they had, but once they had it, we found out that they were going to have a committee. She told me about it, and I hopped on. I said, yes, I want to be part of that committee. And once we did that research on my uncle, you know, we found out that there were 27 others, and I said, I want to know about the other family members as well, you know.
Was there ever a time, I'm just trying to put myself in your family's shoes, because there weren't these records, because there wasn't a written history, where people didn't believe them, or where that story was questioned?
I don't think it was questioned. I just don't, I believe that they just didn't believe that they were on the ship because there were no records. They were hard to find. So once we found these records, it became more believable, more brought them more to life.
And the time and energy you've invested in putting this book together, what have you gotten out of that? Are there some things you've learned or maybe some experiences just in the process that stand out for you?
There was a lot to learn. I was not surprised that the information was not out there, but I feel like this is going to add to America's history. And by us putting this book together, I feel like someone's going to grab this book or someone is going to talk about the book and say, hey, did you hear about this book about the African Americans? And then maybe that person might say, well, I had a friend that knew someone that was on the ship. Matter of fact, they gave me a picture, and it's in my attic, you know. So hopefully it would just open up more doors, and we'll find out even more information about the African Americans that were on the ship, or maybe even find out information about others that were on the ship that weren't African Americans. More stories. You just never know. So it's just an added addition to the story already in place.
And for someone who buys this book and takes the time to read through it, what do you hope that they get from it? What do you hope they take away from that experience?
Just to do your research, do whatever stories that you hear about anything. Just dig a little deeper and see what's behind it. Don't just look at what you see in front of you. Just dig. You never know what you're going to find when you dig a little more, just a little more and a little more. You'll be surprised. There's a lot of history in America.
What can you tell me about your uncle? I mean, that's part of the point of this is to tell the stories of guys who haven't had their stories told. So how much of a story can you present to us?
And that's the thing. I did not know my uncle. My aunt didn't know him, of course. My grandmother only spoke of him a few times, but we didn't really know him. So to do the research on him and just find out his birth date, when he came on board and the different ships, it kind of brought him more to life for us. We just knew he existed. But this brought him more to life for us. So it was a great experience. So not just to bring him to life, but all of the African Americans that were on the ship.
Last question. I don't know if it's an easy question, but if you think back to before you started this journey and this book project, to everything you know now or how you see the world now, do you see a difference? Is there a way that taking part in this has changed you?
It hasn't changed me because I know how African Americans were treated then. And I know there's a lot of history that has not been told, but it made it exciting that I was part of unraveling this piece of history, and hopefully it will inspire others to do the same with other stories.
That's Janice Alston. You heard her mention her aunt Arlene. That would be Arlene Taylor, who also worked on the book, Heroes in the Shadows, in honor of her uncle, Steward's Mate First Class Henry Jackson.
Well, when I was growing up, the only thing I knew about my Uncle Henry was from my mother's reminiscing and talking about him. He was her older brother by about 5 years. So he was also her, I guess, protector, provider, and she loved him dearly. So from my earliest recollection, my mom would always talk about the fact that she never knew what happened to him. He went to the Navy and didn't come back. Letters came saying that he had passed, died at sea, but she was always haunted by the fact that, you know, she never got a chance to say that final goodbye. She just thought he was going to go and come back in a few months or whatever. So when I was a little girl, she always talked about how much she loved and missed him and wanted to know what happened to him. Yeah, so that was my motivation, you know, for doing the research also. But of course, she's passed on now, but I'm sure she's pleased with the book.
So you've had that in your consciousness your whole life. What was the trigger? What brought this book and this project to life?
Well, first of all, as everyone says, you run into a brick wall where you can't get any more information. And I had reached that point probably about 20 years ago when I retired as an educator. So I just put everything in a folder, put it aside. Fast forward to the pandemic, and I got a letter from Jane. Jane had been in contact with the Naval Museum, and they did have a copy. I'd just given the Naval Museum in Washington, D.C., a copy of my uncle's photograph. They had his record, but no photograph. And so I was able to supply the photograph. And then maybe a month or so later, Jane sent me an email and said, I'm a member of an organization called Legacy. Would you like to share your story on the 2020 Zoom conference? And I said, no, I don't think so. I don't have that much information, you know. And so I said no initially, but I watched the program. And then I said, well, maybe I can, you know, give a little bit of information. And Jane just pulled together my information, which was more than I thought I had. I had letters and documents, newspaper clippings and things like that. So she pulled that together, and the other ladies, we all came in with just a handful of information. We worked together like tirelessly for 2.5 years to get that story together in a format that we thought people would be interested, you know, reading.
Yeah, just that piece, meeting these other ladies and realizing there were other families that have had this similar unanswered question or this quest. What did that do for you to connect with them?
For me, it was not only exhilarating, but in a way motivating also, because when I run into the brick wall, I thought, well, there's nothing else to do. I don't know of anyone else who may have had a relative. But when I found out through the Legacy organization that there were at least two others, it gave me a revitalization and motivation to search a little more and maybe put our stories together. So I was very, very pleased to find out that there were others.
And now to see this book in print, to have people lined up, to have you autograph that book and know that they're going to read it and they're going to learn about your uncle and 27 others whose stories have never been told. What does that mean to you?
First of all, it's a fulfillment to my mom's memory. Because I know her, on her dying bed, when she was dying, she still wondered about her brother. She still said, I love Henry. I wonder what happened to him. So I feel like it's a fulfillment for my mom, too. Also, it's to give honor to my uncle. I never knew him except through my mother. And I thought, he needs to be recognized. He needs to be acknowledged. He was a hero. And so the book now will present not only my uncle, but, like you said, 27 other men who were kind of erased from history. And so we're shining that light on them again, and hopefully others will come up as they read these stories, will think of other people in their lives, the people that they knew of, that also should join in, not necessarily on the USS Indianapolis, but other areas of life, in history and everyday life. We have to acknowledge everyone. Everyone has a contribution. I just like to say that if it weren't for the Legacy Organization and organizations like this and people like Jane, I think there are so many other stories and so many other people would like to share information. I wish there were more organizations like Legacy and people like Jane, because all of our stories are important. They're all part of the tapestry of human life. And as an American, you know, we all had a part. Our ancestors, just like everyone else, a part in building this country and making it what it is today. So there are a lot of stories, and I'm hoping Heroes will bring a lot more stories out into the light.
Perhaps a few of you listening right now hold some of those clues, those nuggets of information, maybe even those photographs that can unlock even more of the story. Thanks again to Arlene Taylor, Janice Alston, Ernestine Pete, Dr. Jeanette Pitts, and Jane Gwynn Goodall for their time, not to mention all the time they spent putting together this book, Heroes in the Shadows. And for one final perspective, we turn to one of the foremost authorities on the Indy story. He's the chairman of the USS Indianapolis Legacy Organization, retired Navy Captain William Toty, whose significant military accomplishments include serving as the final commander of another USS Indianapolis, the Los Angeles-class submarine that was in service until 1998.
This book reveals kind of a, you would think it's a microcosm of the history of a single ship and a group of sailors, African-American sailors on that ship. But it's not really just that microcosm. It's actually endemic of a much larger story in the history of the Navy. And it's a dark story, one that we don't want to think about, but is true. And the fact that these African-Americans and Filipinos were grouped together in a class, a second-class category of sailors. So you've got a group of American citizens who are African-American and a group of people who aren't Americans. And they're all kind of categorized together and given very limited opportunities to serve on Navy ships during that time. You know, as it turns out, in this case, none of them survived. They suffered this horrible fate because of where they were berthed when the ship was torpedoed. So because none of them survived, we don't really know their stories until we really start digging into it. That was a lot of work to get that done, and that work is reflected in this book.
And you've been familiar with this story for a long time. Does it feel to you like an onion where more layers keep getting peeled off? And do you have a feel for what layers may still be to come? Because I'm thinking back, you know, since people really started engaging with this story, we've seen Captain McVeigh exonerated. We've seen, you know, the documentary that Sarah worked on, the book with Lynn and Sarah, now this book. What's next? What do you think could still come that we may still learn about the Indy that we don't know yet?
That's the incredible part about the, you know, that's an overused metaphor, the layers of an onion, but it really is true here. Because the more we discover, little bits and snippets are revealed, and then you chase those elements down and you find another entire category of information opens up. I still have been, I've been saying for two decades without evidence that Captain McVeigh decided to cease zigzagging because he knew of the ultra intelligence that indicated that we were reading the Japanese mail. And so when people in Guam told him, you're going to be in a bathtub, basically, it's backwater. There are no submarines in the area you're going to transit through. He's listening to those words with the knowledge that the people who are telling them this are reading Japanese message traffic and know precisely where those submarines are. If he didn't know about Ultra, then he might have been more cautious and made a different decision and continued zigzagging after dark, regardless of what the weather conditions were. But because he was chairman of the Combined Chiefs of Staff Intelligence Committee in his job prior to being CO of Indianapolis, in my opinion, he would have been cleared ultra. And so he's almost got too much information, and he trusted his routing officers more than he should have in retrospect. I still think that whole element of the story that I've been telling for 20 years without data, I think sooner or later data will be revealed, which kind of gives credence to the story I've been telling for 20 years. Because as a Navy officer myself, I've been in situations where I believed certain things because I knew certain intelligence that later turned out I shouldn't have been so trusting of the intelligence. And that lesson to me predates my assertions on McVeigh, but informs my opinion. And so I very strongly believe that that's a story that's going to be revealed over time.
Is there part of the Indianapolis story or the Indianapolis legacy that you find yourself having to set straight sometimes? Are there some misconceptions that you're still dealing with, having been so closely associated now for so long?
Nearly every day. In fact, after I was elected chairman of the legacy organization, I put together a web page on the USSIndianapolis.com website that specifically addresses the large category of mythology that has emerged since 1945. And some of it was created by authors who wanted a great reveal in their book or in their article. So they take a rumor or innuendo and they, kind of push it out as if it were ground truth. And it turns out to have been invented. And so, things like Captain McVeigh holding a toy sailor or soldier in his hand when he committed suicide. I went to the police report. I have the photographs that were taken of his body as they discovered him. And there is no toy sailor or soldier. There's no delineation of it or exposition of it in the police report. There are other myths like that, that I think need to be addressed. And so I always ask reporters who want to do a story on the Indianapolis to go to the webpage and make sure that they understand the myths before they start reporting, because reporters often repeat the myths because they're breathless, right? This story is so incredible, it doesn't need embellishment. It really doesn't need any embellishment. And so it's heartbreaking that people do embellish it because the bones of the story itself are so unbelievable. And so I really do want people to go to the website, understand why the real number of survivors is 316, not 317, understand all these various facts, what the truth is that we know about the sharks, because that's been greatly embellished, and everything else. Because focus on what really happened and the real heroes, not the breathless hyperbole that's emerged from the story.
One last question, if there's anything you want to add, feel free. But you've been involved with this for a long time, so many reunions in so many different places, the surprise of the ship being discovered a few years back, now this new chapter of its history with Heroes in the Shadows. But how special was it to have this reunion here in Benicia with the statue for Harold while he's still here to soak it in?
It's an amazing coincidence that Harold, the last remaining survivor, lives 8 miles away from the last port of call that the ship made in the United States before its fateful voyage that ended in its sinking. So initially we thought we'd come out here just to be close to Harold, because we thought maybe he wouldn't be able to travel to us if we had it somewhere else, and he needed to be part of this reunion. But then when it occurred to me that, well, wait a minute, we're just a few miles away from Mare Island Naval Shipyard, where the ship went through its final refit after the kamikaze attack. So this would have been the port where the crew had its last liberty, its last true time off, because after they got underway to bring the bomb to Tinian, it was constant work to the point where they were sunk. So this is the last time the crew would have had to decompress to have a good time. And so we thought maybe that ought to be the theme of this reunion, that celebrate the crew's wonderful, time in and around Mare Island, San Francisco, Bay Area. Make that the theme, the focus of this reunion. Because over the years, over the decades, we have spent plenty of time thinking about and talking about the sinking and the terrible ordeal that occurred after that. This gave us an opportunity. I think that the crew that was lost would want the families to think about the good times that they had right before the ship was on its final voyage. We tried to make that the theme. We need to remember the loss and the suffering, and we didn't ignore that during this reunion. But we did really want to focus on the good times that they had right before that final voyage, and I hope it was successful in doing so.
That's retired Navy Captain Bill Todi, chair of the USS Indianapolis Legacy Organization, which has a tremendous website for you to explore, and I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where you can also order this new book, Heroes in the Shadows. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we'll be reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.